And as I said a little bit earlier, I've been thinking about past days of atonement, and I know that many of you, you know, here have sat in the field house without air conditioning with the fans blowing with, you know, 1,000 other people or so, and some of you may have, you know, had other experiences. If anyone recollects, I'd really like to know after services, did we ever keep the Day of Atonement in the festival building? I don't remember that. I remember how warm the festival building on the Big Sandy campus could be during the Feast of Tabernacles, but I don't recall keeping a Day of Atonement there. But if those of you that have, I'd appreciate your experience on that if you have. My first Day of Atonement was in California in 1964 in the Central Valley. We lived about 70 miles from Fresno and didn't have air conditioning in the car. And it was time to go to the Day of Atonement, or the services at the Day of Atonement. 70 miles at that time was a little over, well, an hour and 15 to hour and 30 minute drive. And we sat through a lengthy service and then drove all the way home in that unair-conditioned car. And this was my introduction to fasting, from not ever having fasted, not having ever really thought about it, to going the whole day the first time. And I'm glad that we are wiser in the Church of God present time frame than we were in those days in terms of how we prepare children and give children the opportunity to, you know, to gradually become used to fasting and to, you know, work into that in a much easier manner than the way that some might have done it in the past. You know, when you look on current events right now and you look at, you know, you do a Google search and Google knows everything about everything, as we all know, that, you know, you see something, you type in Yom Kippur and see what comes up. And the focus this year struck me in a different kind of way, it's a different way than it has in the past, is how much the focus was on, you know, what is fasting? What do you wear? You know, there are some very definite guidelines in Judaism as to what you can or what you're recommended to wear or not wear for the Day of Atonement, preparation for the meal on the afternoon before the Day of Atonement starts, and lots of different things. There's nothing that I saw at all about the origin of the Day of Atonement. And, you know, some of the things that Mr. Flynn brought out that we're going to go back through here in a little bit, I'm really struck by that. Not much said about sin. You know, it's more of a focus on, you know, you're humbling yourself. You're seeking reconciliation. In Judaism, it's considered the holiest day of the year. And there's the focus on, on that aspect of trying to ensure that your name is in the book of life, or in the books that are talked about there. And I thought this year that struck me in a different way in terms of looking at atonements in the past and then what we look to as the fulfillment of the Day of Atonement in the future. And that's what I want to focus on in the time that we have this afternoon, is atonements in the past or at the beginning, and then atonement in the future, the fulfillment of it. You know, the theme of this day is how all humanity will be reconciled to God. That is one of the primary themes of the significance and of the meaning of this day. You know, we all need to be reconciled to God because we've been separated from God by our sins. You know, and Isaiah 59:2 says that. You know, it says, "But your iniquities have separated you from your God. Your sins have hidden his face from you so that he will not hear you." So as Mr. Flynn brought out, in the Garden of Eden, there was conciliation. God and man were together. There was no division at the time that they were created. Satan shows up, does his deception, and there is separation. Adam and Eve are thrust out of the garden. They're not permitted to come back to the garden ever again. And at that point, from that time to present day, there has been that separation as a result of sin. Now, this Day of Atonement is about how humanity can be at one with God. It's how we can have at-one-ment, or the state the condition of being at one with God. And this day is one of the ways that that reconciliation or that that separation is resolved, and that we and that God will have reconciliation with all mankind. An aspect of this day is that it recognizes the origin of sin and death. It recognizes the origin of sin and death. Let's go back to Leviticus 23, and we'll start where Mr. Flynn did, and we'll go over that, the verses 27 to 32. Why are we doing what we're doing today? And we're doing this by command. You know, these are the feasts of the Lord in the 23rd, chapter of Leviticus, and you know, right here and toward the end of the chapter is a fairly lengthy passage about the Day of Atonement. I was struck by something that was said earlier in the year of how little is said by comparison about some of the other feasts and how much is written about some of the others. And we look at the Day of Atonement, Feast of Trumpets up above, it's only got, you know, 2.5 verses written about it. The Day of Atonement has a lot more material here about this feast, and about this day. Let's start in verse 27, we'll read to 32. Also, the 10th day of the 7th month shall be the Day of Atonement. Shall be a holy convocation for you. You shall afflict your souls and offer an offering made by fire to the Lord. We understand that affliction in this case is that we fast. You know, I'm thinking about fasting. You know, I think, wow, am I ever thankful that God didn't want us to fast for 3 days or 7 days? You know, we think about the biblical example of extended fasts in the Bible, Moses being up on the mountain for 40 days and 40 nights. In the presence of God, didn't need to eat. Jesus Christ fasted for 40 days before the temptation. And I think, wow, you know, I'm grateful for the mercy of God that our affliction is one day long. And it doesn't take very long for us, to, or at least for me, to get the point of how fragile and how temporal I really am. When I don't eat for a while, I miss my morning coffee terribly. All of those kinds of things that, you know, it doesn't take very long, and my body is not operating, my mind is not operating the way that I would hope it would. You know, I'm a little out of sorts. I'm a little afflicted, you know, in that. And what does that produce? Hopefully it produces humility. We recognize the dependence that we have on God and Jesus Christ, and that without them and without their love and their mercy and their plan and their purpose and their objective of bringing many sons to glory and reconciling all mankind to themselves, you know, we'd be in a pretty bad place. Continuing in 28, and you shall do no work on that same day, for it's the Day of Atonement, to make atonement for you before the Lord your God. I'm going to mention two words here. The Day of Atonement comes from the Hebrew word in this verse called Kippur, Yom Kippur. And to make an atonement is the Hebrew word kafar. Kippur is based on kafar, which we'll get to some meanings of that here in a little bit. Verse 29, for any person who's not afflicted in soul on that same day shall be cut off from his people. Any person who does any work on that same day, that person, says God, I will destroy from among his people. You shall do no manner of work. It should be a statute forever throughout your generations and all your dwellings. And verse 32, it shall be to you a Sabbath of solemn rest, and you shall afflict your souls. It's restated again. On the 9th day at even. Very specific instructions. Okay, the 9th day at even until from evening to evening, you shall celebrate your Sabbath. In Judaism, it's a 25-hour fast. It's not a 24-hour fast. It's a 25-hour fast because there is a focus apparently on nightfall in terms of at the end of the Day of Atonement. So it starts at sunset. It ends at what is called in Judaism nightfall. The instruction here is real clear in that last verse, evening to evening. So, you know, you can look at that and see what, you know, what God wrote or recorded for us. Back to those two words. Atonement, Kippur, is from the word kafar. And there really is not an English word that directly translates from this. And kafar has these meanings. from which Kippur is derived. Kafara means to cover or to purge, to make an atonement, to make reconciliation. And it also means to cover over with pitch. It's the same word that was used when Noah was given instructions about putting pitch on the ark. But it's used to refer to covering. To cover what? I think that'll become clearer when we go a little farther. Let's turn back, and I mentioned a little bit earlier about the amount that is written about different feasts and different holy days. Let's go back to the 16th chapter of the book of Leviticus, and this is the whole chapter is dedicated to the Day of Atonement. And let's start, we don't have time to read all the chapter, we'll read about half of it there, maybe skip through some of the details for the sake of time. Leviticus 16, verse 1. Now the Lord spoke to Moses after the death of the two sons of Aaron when they offered profane fire before the Lord and died. That refers back to the events in the 10th chapter of the book of Leviticus. Nadab and Abihu didn't follow the instructions that they had been given, and they did something different, and that very greatly displeased the Lord, and it cost them their lives. And I want to hop back there to the 10th chapter and read that first verse. And then Nadab and Abihu, the sons of Aaron, each took his censer, put fire on it, put incense on it, offered profane fire before the Lord, which he had not commanded them. So fire went out from the Lord and devoured them, and they died before the Lord. Moses said to Aaron this was a startling event, that priesthood is just getting really established and operational, and then you have two priests that are killed on the spot by fire from the Lord. Moses said to Aaron in verse 3, this is what the Lord spoke, saying, by those who come near me, I must be regarded as holy, and before all the people, I must be glorified. And so in verse 10, it says, basically, the point of this is that you may distinguish between the holy and the unholy, between the clean and the unclean. They didn't follow the instructions that they were given, and they were killed on the spot for it. And then these instructions in Leviticus 16 that reference that then follow on to it. So we'll go back to 16 and continue in verse 2. The Lord said to Moses, tell Aaron your brother not to come just any time into the holy place inside the veil before the mercy seat, which is on the ark, lest he die. And this is repeated numerous times through Leviticus 16. These aren't just idle words here. And, there's a possible reference or connection in Leviticus 10 that perhaps Nadab and Abihu had some alcoholic beverages or something, because there is a prescription from using any kind of wine or strong drink in the service of God. So that seems to be kind of an odd thing to put into that chapter if it did not have some bearing on what happened with Nadab and Abihu. But that's speculative. But that is there. And so you can't help but wonder, was that what led them to make the mistake that they did? But that was a very serious incident. And, here in verse 2, he's given instructions, lest he die. Do this specifically. If you don't, it may cost you your life. Verse 3, thus Aaron shall come into the holy place with the blood of a young bull as the sin offering, and of a ram, and it's a burnt offering. And so we got the very detailed instructions about what was supposed to be brought in for offering, and now we're going to go through, here's how you're supposed to dress. He should put on the holy linen tunic, the linen trousers on his body, should be girded with a linen sash, with the linen turban shall he be attired. These are holy garments. Therefore he shall wash his body in water and put them on. Verse 5, and he shall take from the congregation of the children of Israel two kids of the goats, as a sin offering, and one ram as a burnt offering. And then verse 6, Aaron shall offer the bull as a sin offering, for which is for himself, make atonement for himself and for his house. Then verse 7, he shall take the two goats, present them before the Lord at the door of the tabernacle of meeting, Verse 8, then Aaron shall cast lots for the two goats, one for the Lord and the other lot for the scapegoat, as it's translated in the King James and in the New King James. That is an unfortunate choice of words. I want to stop at this point and go over some reference material that hopefully will help better understand some of the challenges that the translators faced and some of the choices that they made. You'll notice in other translations that it doesn't say scapegoat, it says Azazel. Azazel. That is the Hebrew word that this comes from. The challenge is, what does that mean? What does Azazel mean? So let me read to you a little bit about the significance of the choice of the word scapegoat. And this is from dictionary.com. And this is important because of the symbolism that is placed on these two goats. A scapegoat is a person or group made to bear the blame for others or to suffer in their place. There's the implication with this is that it may not be their fault, but it's someone that is bearing the blame for others or is suffering in their place. And then, you know, the dictionary.com actually has a reference that says it's a goat let loose in the wilderness on Yom Kippur after the high priest symbolically laid the sins of the people on its head. And, you know, the verses in Leviticus 16 are 8, 10, and 26 where that word Azazel is used. From Collins English Dictionary, the complete non-abridged 10th edition, it has some information about the origin of the English word scapegoat. And this word didn't exist until the early 1500s. And it was actually created, it was put together by William Tyndale, you know, to translate the Hebrew word Azazel. So that it's the conjunction of the word scape and goat. So this is something that was contrived, and the translators have, and various scholars have, you know, have struggled with how do we translate this? What does Azazel actually mean? But remember, William Tyndale created the word scapegoat in 1530. So these verses were written somewhere, or these events were recorded, you know, 3,500 years ago from where we are today. From the Online Etymology Dictionary, there's some things said about this that said that the goat sent into the wilderness, talking about what scapegoat means, the symbolic bearer of sins of the people, and they also say that it was coined by William Tyndale. Some people say that the translators struggled with a mistranslation of a Latin version, the Septuagint, and they mistranslated Azazel to they should have translated it the goat that departs or the goat of departure, but they didn't. So they came up with this with the scapegoat, and it shows up in different translations in that form as either scapegoat or Azazel. Finally, Jameson Fawcett Brown commentary on Leviticus 16 says this, it was then delivered, and they're talking about the goat upon which the high priest confessed the sins of the people on, that it was then delivered into the hands of a person who was appointed to lead him away into a distant and solitary desert place, where in early times he was let go to escape for his life. In the time of Christ, this goat was carried to a high rock that was about 12 miles from Jerusalem, and it was actually pushed off the precipice and was killed. It's a different practice there. So some things had been added, some things had been changed there by this time. Now, commentators, according to Jameson Fawcett Brown, commentators have differed widely in their opinions about the character and purpose of this part of the ceremonial. Some considering the word Azazel with the Septuagint and our translators to mean scapegoat. Others think that it might mean a large or a lofty precipitous rock. Others a thing separated to God, which is that's difficult for me to understand that. And then while others think that it refers to Satan himself. There are some other references that say that that there was there is a Canaanite deity named Aziz that some scholars think that this is a reference to. But given our understanding of the plan of God and of the Holy Day plan, I think we can correctly conclude that these two goats, the one that is offered for a sin offering, is symbolic of Jesus Christ. The other goat is symbolic of Satan and the devil. And as Mr. Flynn was pointing out, you know, the Satan bears responsibility for the sins of mankind. We'll see a little bit more in terms of that a little bit later from the Bible. We have our own challenges. We have our own mistakes that we've made. But Satan bears a lot of the responsibility for the state of the world at present. Let's continue then. So after, so we've got the two goats, the one that here in the King James, New King James is translated scapegoat. We could say this is a better translation. It's probably the goat of departure for that word scapegoat from the Hebrew Azazel. Verse 9, and Aaron shall bring the goat which the Lord's lot on which the Lord's lot fell and offer it as a sin offering. So that goat is its life is taken. It dies. It is a sin offering. Verse 10, but the goat on which the lot fell to be the scapegoat or the Azazel shall be presented alive before the Lord to make atonement upon it and to let it go as the Azazel into the wilderness. And Aaron shall bring the bull, and we've got a whole list of different things that he has to do in terms of, you know, offering this bull. Then he takes a censer with incense on it, and he has the instructions that he's been given that he is to perform when he goes into the most holy place. And we'll continue to drop down to 15. Then he shall kill the goat of the sin offering, which is for the people, bring the blood inside the veil, do with that blood as he did with the blood of the bull, and that is to sprinkle it on the mercy seat and before the mercy seat. So he shall make atonement for the holy place because of the uncleanness of the children of Israel, and because of their transgressions for all of their sins, so shall he do for the tabernacle of meeting which remains among them in the midst of their uncleanness. Then verse 17 says, you know, he's in there by himself. There shall be no man in the tabernacle of meeting when he goes in to make atonement for the holy place until he comes out, that he may make atonement for himself, his household, and for all the assembly of Israel. He shall go out to the altar that is before the Lord, make atonement for it, take some of the blood of the bull, some of the blood of the goat, and put on the horns of the altar all around. And, you know, we go through these instructions. They're very detailed. They're very, you know, structured in terms of, you know, the number of times that he was to sprinkle blood on different parts of different things, you know, at that place. But that was what God wanted done at that time. Verse 20. Well, verse 19, then he shall sprinkle some of the blood on it with his finger seven times, cleanse it, consecrate it from the uncleanness of the children of Israel. When he's made an end of atoning for the holy place, the tabernacle of meeting, excuse me, and the altar, he shall bring the live goat. And Aaron shall lay both of his hands on the head of the live goat and confess over it all the iniquities of the children of Israel and all of their transgressions, concerning all of their sins, putting them on the head of the goat, and shall send it away into the wilderness by the hand of a fit man. So symbolically, Aaron is confessing all of the sins for himself, his household, and the children of Israel, and symbolically placing those sins on that goat that symbolizes Satan the devil and symbolizes his bearing the responsibility for the sins of all mankind. And then that goat is banished, taken out into the desert by the hands of a fit man. And then that guy comes back, and the goat's out there. And at some point, that's the end of the goat. I'd like to spend a few minutes to look at some attributes of Satan symbolized by that goat of departure. And These you can turn to them if you want, or since they're just single verses, I can just read them to you. Revelation 12:9. These are attributes, characteristics of that goat of departure, or of Satan the devil, that goat of departure symbolized. Revelation 12:9. So the great dragon was cast out, that serpent of old called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world. He deceives the whole world. He has that kind of power. Ephesians 2:1-2. And the Apostle Paul writing, and you he made alive who were dead in trespasses and sins, in which you once walked according to the course of this world, according to the prince of the power of the air. He's referred to as an extremely powerful being that inhabits, you know, this biosphere that we call Earth, the prince of the power of the air. And we walked before we knew what we were doing spiritually in that sense. We walked that same way. We walked according to the course of the world, and that's what that is the result of Satan's choices. That's the result of his influence. That's the result of how he deals with humanity. He's a deceiver. He's a very powerful deceiver. Matthew 13:19 has an interesting statement, and this is out of the parable of the sower. You know, and how that's presented in the different ways that seed is sown and the different responses. And the one I want to focus on is Matthew 13:19. When anyone hears the word of the kingdom and does not understand it, then the wicked one comes and snatches away what was sown in his heart. This is he who received the seed by the wayside. So we see Satan in this particular case being described as actively going after someone that has received the seed. And he goes out there and he damages that person. He snatches that information. He snatches that seed away from that person. He prevents that person from going to the next step in their understanding. You know, he has, in that sense, he's interfered with that person's ability to respond to calling. That's a very serious act. 2 Corinthians 4:3-4, another aspect of Satan. But even if our gospel is veiled, said the Apostle Paul, it's veiled to those who are perishing, whose minds the God of this age has blinded. He has the capacity to affect us in that way. He can blind, he can twist and warp and divert our understanding. Whose minds the God of this age has blinded, who do not believe, lest the light of the glorious, or of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God, should shine on them. He is out to damage humanity as extensively as he possibly can. And he's accountable for that. And the Day of Atonement pictures past and future, the resolution of that, and the recognition of that accountability, and the effect of the judgment that has already been placed upon him, has not yet been executed, but has already been placed upon him. John 8:44, Jesus Christ responding to the Pharisees, "You're of your father, the devil, and the desires of your father you want to do." And Jesus Christ characterizes Satan this way. He was a murderer from the beginning. What was the result for Adam and Eve when Eve was deceived and believed a lie? The instructions were, you can eat of everything in the garden except this one tree. But if you do, it's at pain of death. So in that sense, he killed Adam and Eve with that deception. He was a murderer from the beginning, does not stand in the truth because there's no truth in him. When he speaks a lie, he speaks from his own resources, for he's the liar and the father of it. You know, I think sometimes about Mother Eve. Never been lied to. Neither had Adam. You know, that was foreign to them. Along comes, you know, Satan in the form of this creature and hauls off and tells them, you're not going to die. God told you this, but that's not the way it's going to turn out. And they believed it, or she believed it. She was deceived. And he lied and basically you know, cost them their lives, changed the, you know, their course at that point. The last verse from this section, 2 Corinthians 11, verse 3. But I fear lest somehow, as the serpent deceived Eve by his craftiness. Sometimes I've thought about this. Do we think Satan fights fair? Do you think he's just going to line up on the other side of the ring, you know, from you, and it's going to be really clear as to what he stands for, what he's after, anything like that? He's crafty. He's cunning. He's deceitful. He's going to do everything but fight fair. And I think, you know, for us to think that he would deal with us any other way except that is naive on our part. That he is a tremendously powerful, influential adversary. And without God's protection, without God's hope, we would be toast. Now then, as before we bridge to atonement in the future, I'd like to go over to the 10th chapter of Hebrews and read the comments by the author of the book of Hebrews about the sacrificial system. And some would call this the insufficiency of the sacrificial system. The first four verses of Hebrews, the 10th chapter. Hebrews 10:1. For the law, having a shadow of the good things to come and not the very image of the things, can never, with these same sacrifices which they offer continually year by year, make those who approach perfect. Sacrifices are not going to perfect those that were offering those sacrifices, what that verse says. Verse 2, for then would they not cease to be offered? We'd still be offering the sacrifices if they truly forgave sin. Continuing in verse 2, for the worshipers, once purified, would have had no more consciousness of sin. Verse 3, but in those sacrifices there is a reminder of sins every year. And we're reminded of that as we keep this Day of Atonement. Verse 4, the conclusion, for it is not possible that the blood of bulls and goats could take away sins. So what happened? They went through the rituals. The word talks about covering. But the sins were not forgiven. The sins weren't taken away in that sense. Now then, let's back up to the 9th chapter of Hebrews, and we'll read about Jesus Christ, the high priest, our high priest, and we'll read, we'll go back to Hebrews 7 here for a second, but we're going to go through and read the author of the book of Hebrews' contrast and comparison of the old sacrificial system and the role of Jesus Christ as our high priest now. Let me read three verses out of Hebrews 7 to you, Hebrews 7:25 through 27. Jesus Christ, our high priest, says, therefore he, that is Jesus Christ, is also able to save to the uttermost those who come to God through him, since he always lives to make intercession for them. For such a high priest was fitting for us, who is holy, harmless, undefiled, separate from sinners, and has become higher than the heavens. Verse 27, who does not need daily, as those high priests, to offer up sacrifices, first for his own sins and then for the people. For this he did once for all when he offered up himself. And so we see the sacrifice of Jesus does cover sins, but in a different way. It provides the remission of sins, the forgiveness of sins by his sacrifice. Now then, let's go to the 9th chapter of Hebrews, and we'll start in verse 6. Hebrews 9 and verse 6. Now when these things had been thus prepared, the priests always went into the first part of the tabernacle performing the services. But into the second part, the high priest went alone once a year, not without blood. And we saw in Leviticus 16 those excruciating details of all of that shedding of blood, the different sacrifices, the different animals that they were required to do. What the high priest went once a year, not without blood, which he offered for himself for the people's sins committed in ignorance. Verse 8, the Holy Spirit indicating this, that the way into the holiest of all was not yet made manifest while the first tabernacle was still standing. There's some significance in the 25th chapter of Matthew that when Jesus Christ, at the point that he was crucified, the veil in the temple rent from top to bottom. There's symbolism in that the way to the most holy place was available to Christians, or would be available to Christians through Jesus Christ in a special way that had never been there before, as this verse just says, that there wasn't any way into the most holy place up to this period of time. As long as that first tabernacle was standing with the sacrificial system in place, that's just the way that it was. That's the way it was. Verse 9, it was symbolic for the present time in which both gifts and sacrifices are offered, which cannot make him who performed the service perfect in regard to conscience. And we have that same point made again about, you know, did it cover the sins or did it forgive the sins? Verse 11. Verses 11 to 15. But Christ came as high priest of the good things to come with the greater and more perfect tabernacle, not made with hands, that is, not of this creation, not with the blood of goats and calves, but with his own blood, entered the most holy place once for all, having obtained eternal redemption. For if the blood of bulls and goats and the ashes of a heifer sprinkling the unclean sacrifices for the purifying of the flesh, how much more shall the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself without spot to God, cleanse your conscience from dead works to serve the living God? Verse 15. And for this reason, he, that is Jesus, is the mediator of the new covenant by means of death, for the redemption of the transgressions under the first covenant, that those who are called may receive the promise of eternal inheritance. Let's drop down to verse 21, please. We have some more instructions about blood and some comments about blood, but let's drop down to 21. Then likewise he sprinkled with blood both the tabernacle and all the vessels of the ministry. And according to the law, almost all things are purified with blood, and without the shedding of blood, there is no remission. Without the shedding of blood, there is no remission from sin, or no remission of sin. And that is the significance of the sacrifice of Jesus Christ. He shed his blood. That covers all of our sins. It covers potentially all of the sins for all people who have ever lived at that time. Verse 23, therefore it was necessary that the copies of the things in the heavens should be purified with these, but the heavenly things themselves with better sacrifices than these. Verse 24, for Christ has not entered the holy places made with hands, which are copies of the true, which I find that fascinating in terms of, the reference to things in heaven. Copies of the true, but in heaven itself, now to appear in the presence of God for us. I misread that, I'm sorry. Christ is, verse 24, for Christ has not entered the holy places made with hands, which are copies of the true, but into heaven itself, now to appear in the presence of God for us. He's our intercessor, he's our advocate with the Father. Not that he should offer himself often, as the high priest entered the most holy place every year, with the blood of another. 26, he would then have had to suffer often since the foundation of the world. But now, once at the end of the ages, he has appeared to put away sin by the sacrifice of himself. And as it is appointed for men once to die, but after this the judgment, verse 28, so Christ was offered once to bear the sins of many. To those who eagerly await for him, he will appear a second time apart from sin for salvation. And then we fast forward to the fulfillment of this day in the future. And what will happen in the song that Mr. Richards led us in there, When Christ Shall Come, is one hymn that covers all four of the last, or the last four holy days, you know, just in a remarkable, beautiful way there, you know, when Christ shall come. I really, really like that hymn. I think that we're faced with the reality or the recognition, when we look at the world today, we've got every flavor of government that man can come up with in the countries around the world. When Christ comes, there's not room for more than one government. There's not room for two governments. There's not room for a government, a spiritual organization that Satan operates as the prince of the power of the air, to be coexistent with the government of Jesus Christ. And so once Jesus Christ returns, the next waypoint along the way in God's plan is the fulfillment of this day. I want to read a couple of verses out let me just read one out of the Gospel of John, that 14:30 said, and he's speaking to the disciples, "I will no longer talk much with you, for the ruler of this world is coming, and he has nothing in me." That actually wasn't the one I wanted. John 16:11, it said, "Of judgment, because the ruler of this world is judged." At that point, Satan basically was displaced. He lost his position, or would lose his position when that sentence was executed. And this day that we are keeping today looks forward to the fulfillment of that judgment, to the execution of that judgment. If you would, let's turn over to the 20th chapter of Revelation to conclude. 20th chapter of Revelation. Beginning in verse 1, Revelation 20. "Then I saw an angel coming down from heaven, having the key to the bottomless pit and a great chain in his hand. Verse 2, he laid hold of the dragon, that serpent of old, who is the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years. And he cast him into the bottomless pit and shut him up and set a seal on him, so that he should deceive the nations no more till the 1,000 years were finished. But after these things, he must be released for a little while." One of the authors of some of the material that's been published about, you know, holy days by the Church of God has an interesting statement about this, about that Satan being released, you know, for that short period of time. He's released for a little while. It said he will test the spiritual commitment of the people alive at that point. You know, and what's he going to tell them? Probably a lot of the same things that he did to Mother Eve. That's not the way that it is. That's not really, God's not really telling you the whole story or ever how he will develop that. But he will deceive the people, or he will deceive a large number of people at that time, because that's what he is. That's how he operates. That's how he has operated as long as he's been in the role of the prince of the power of the air, the ruler of this world. But when Christ comes and this day is fulfilled, then his influence is neutralized, it's nullified, and then humanity is left with the issue of dealing with our own challenges, with our own sins, with our own temptations, with our own pulls, the appetites of the flesh. But Satan is not involved in that. He's restrained, thankfully. Verse 5, "But the rest of the dead did not live again until the 1,000 years were finished." This is the first resurrection. And then let's read through verse 8. "Blessed and holy is he who has part in the first resurrection. Over such the second death has no power. But they shall be priests of God and of Christ, and shall reign with him 1,000 years. When 1,000 years have expired, Satan will be released from his prison. He will go out to deceive the nations which are in the four corners of the earth." He lists them and basically gathers them to battle. So when we look forward to the fulfillment of this day, when it comes to pass in the future, we see that this is one of the ways whereby God is going to reconcile humanity to himself and to resolve that separation, to eliminate the separation that has caused that division between God and mankind because of our sins. The sins that we commit have separated us from God. And by the sacrifice of Jesus Christ and the plan of God, that our sins can be and will be forgiven, and that we can achieve that state with God, and all people can, of at-one-ment, of being at one with God. And as the hymn says, the cause of sin and death will be made plain when Christ shall come again. And that's one of the aspects of this day, is that second goat, the Azazel, that typified and symbolized Satan, there will be the recognition worldwide of, here is the being that is responsible for much of this. Hope you all have a great feast in your travels and travel safe. I look forward to hearing your stories of your Feast of Tabernacles and Last Great Day when we all get back.